For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So, welcome.
Thank you.
And I also wanted to just welcome Steve and Sophia, who are... Where are you from?
Olympia Zen Center. Edo Francis Carney Roshi is my teacher.
Great. And Sophia, are you also from Washington?
Yeah, Olympia, but I live here now.
You live?
I live here.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Great. Well, welcome to your first Ancient Dragon event. And I think most of the usual suspects are here. We kind of know each other. Neo's on. Eric Schutt needs no introduction, but I'll just say...
I think I do. I haven't been around that
much. I'll offer it anyway. And Neozon has been with the Ancient Dragon for many years and is a Dharma teacher and practice leader here, so he's available to meet with on an individual basis. And has... a wide-ranging, long-standing Zen practice most of his life. So, without further ado, please share your Dharma news.
Thank you. Well, Hogetsu said I've been practicing for a while, so now you're probably thinking I'm actually going to say something of interest or use. We'll find out. But before we do that, I would like to do a little more Zazen. So if Douglas would accommodate us. Thank you. Maybe that's enough. Good morning, everybody. I think I maybe do need a little bit of an introduction. I mean, I had some from Hogetsu, but there are a number of people who've probably seen me or hearing me for the first time, so I just wanted to welcome you. Today I want to talk briefly about deep listening. Apropos of no particular event, it's just that I was sort of rummaging through some notes and things from past years trying to come up with an idea of what to speak about today, and I ran across this and I thought I might give it another go. I gave this talk in 2015 in Rockefeller Chapel, so Howard might have heard it, but I'm going to presume you've forgotten it. And maybe Douglas, I don't know. People might have been there. Anyway, deep listening. This is a concept, a notion that I heard about for the first time about in 2015. Heard it for the first time, as in so many cases, I heard it from Taiyin. I I do not remember the events of the time that generated a little discussion around here about deep listening. That's where this comes from. You know, and as I recall, Kaigen introduced the topic, and I don't know if it was in talk or just a conversation, but emphasizing the importance of deep listening as a necessary step for beginning to kind of heal some of the brokenness of our current situation. It's even more broken now than 10 years ago, considerably so. So I've been thinking about it again, and I think it's important. But what is it exactly? What is it? The dictionary definition of listening is to make an effort to hear something, to pay attention, to heed. And I point that out simply because it brings home very strongly that listening, as opposed to hearing, is a very active process. Back in 2015, when I was thinking about this stuff, I went online, as one sometimes does, and found a definition that I thought was good, and I would like to read it to you. It's quite short. Deep listening is a way of hearing in which we are fully present with what is happening in the moment without trying to control it or judge it. We let go of our inner clamoring and our usual assumptions and listen with respect for precisely what is being said. For listening to be effective, we require a contemplative mind, open, fresh, alert, attentive, calm, and receptive. I think you get the gist. I don't think I need to read it again, but does that sound at all familiar to people? David, what does it sound like to you?
Raise my hand to speak. I just raise it and say,
okay. Good to see you. I'm going to give it another go. It's a way of hearing in which we are fully present with what is happening in the moment without trying to control it or judge it. We let go of our inner clamoring and our usual assumptions and listen with respect for precisely what is being said. For listening to be effective, we require a contemplative mind, open, fresh, alert, attentive, calm, and receptive.
This sounds exhausting.
Thank you. Bingo. Exactly. It sounded a lot like Zazen to me as well. And when I looked into who put out this this definition, it's not really a surprise. It's by a group called the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society in Vermont. It's a Vipassana-based organization, but you know, people who sit. Yeah, and I'm, like I said, it's really striking that with a few tweaks, this could be a description of Zazen. And this encourages me to think about Zazen, you know, to kind of flip it and think about listening itself, Zazen itself as a kind of listening, as a type of listening with these qualities that we've just pointed out. It can be easy and difficult, actually, in the same ways as listening to another person. And I know for me, that can sometimes be a challenge, especially when discussing a difficult or painful kind of thing. And it can be hard to set aside assumptions, all the things we talked about, control, judgment, remaining attentive, calm, and receptive. Speaking for myself, in any kind of difficult conversation, it doesn't take me long to witness this inner clamoring of all kinds, self-justification, you know, desire to clarify in such a way as to make criticism kind of besides the point, unconsciously waiting for an opportunity to say something witty or clarifying, to be correct, to be right. Even too much of a desire to understand can get in the way of actually listening to what is being said. substituting an image of agreement and trying to substitute, put that in the place of whatever truth it is that I'm a little unwilling to hear in the moment. And all of this is a kind of a talking back, even before we open our mouths. Now, the reason I asked Douglas to give us a little more unscheduled zazen, just a taste of it, is because I wanted to see what was happening for people in that moment. Okay, I mean, it's not important.
It was way thinkier than my earlier zazen.
Yeah, exactly.
This is like plan, so
what's going on? How long are we going to do this? It just takes very, very little to even in zazen, let alone being out with folks to get that train going, right? A little tap on the shoulder is pretty, you may have a deranged monkey on speed running around for a few minutes until you can get him to realize everything's okay and settle down again. And this is what I'm saying. It's a kind of a talking back that we would do well to I don't want to do anything with it exactly, but we will be happy. We are happy. I am happy in zazen when that settles a bit. And this can take some effort of some kind. But a lot of times when we're doing this monkey mind stuff, the effort is actually in the service of trying to assert some kind of an ideal image of who we are, some kind of an ideal image of, how we sit, all that kind of stuff. We try to make ourselves, defend ourselves against any sense of feeling at fault, all those kinds of things. And this is what Dogen Zenji, one aspect of he might call carrying oneself forward. And I don't think we need to, I think people are familiar with that, so spend time with that. And in conversation, of course, there's going to be time to respond. And when we do, as Buddhists, so now we're talking outside, right? We should be guided by right speech. Broadly speaking, we could say it's a speech that tends towards liberation. Calm, healing, all these kinds of things. And we can do this with greater or lesser degrees of skill. But to do it nobly or skillfully sort of presupposes that we've already done some of the work of not dragging all this kind of back talk, usually silent, into the conversation. So, I don't know. So what this opens up to me is a couple of things. One, that, as Dylan pointed out, this really interesting similarity between zazen and right listening. And it also leads me to consider, and just an idea that people might play with, is, we have the injunction, the request, the proposal that we, as Buddhists, apply right speech. But seeing this kind of relationship sort of seeing, as I was thinking about this, that, in conversations with other people, the conversation that's going on, I'm embarrassed about this. I never really thought about it before, but it's like, if I'm talking to David, it's not only that conversation that I have to attend to. I have to attend to this one as well. And it's very easy to be unconscious of that. So anyway, the sort of playful idea I would like to introduce, and you can fool around with it if you have time or interest, is the idea of expanding the notion of right speech and thinking about it more broadly in terms of, you know, right conversation, i.e. a conversation that fully applies the what is we contact in Zazen to our interactions in the outside world. And with the outside world, and this is a good place to make a footnote. It's actually a little bit embarrassing, I realize, for me to be making this a talk about deep listening or right communication, deep communication, because, you know, on the bus, on the train on the way up here, I realized, you know what, I'm going to be talking to a room of full of people who do this professionally, you know, who've actually been trained in it. Of course, we have our guiding teacher, Hogetsu. We have Howard. We have David, who've been trained in chaplaincy. We've got teachers. So
a psychologist too.
What?
Matthew is also a psychologist.
Matthew, yeah. I mean,
I was trained as an anthropologist.
All right, let's go around the room, and I also have some anthropological training. Let's introduce ourselves again. No, I'm kidding. Because yes, we all have experience in this, and many of you much more than me. So I hope you will, in the conversational part, you will broaden this for me. So anyway, listening to our thoughts in Zazen in this open kind of way is not. It's not trying to hear something exactly. It's not trying to tie things up and make sense or figuring things out, you know, but it's definitely the second part of that definition of just paying attention. If there's an effort about this, it's just to do that as much and as fully as we possibly can. Not speaking back to thoughts and sensations, not telling stories about what's going on, not carrying ourselves forward, just letting things come and go as they do, and to neither chase them away or to run after them. This is the advice we hear all the time. But this, as we all know, is more easily said than done. And, you know, and that was the point of this unscheduled bit of Zazen, is to show, just to make it very, very fresh, how difficult that can be. We're instructed to come back just moment after moment to our breath and our posture. And there are lots of ways, of course, to talk about this. Dogen speaks about taking the backward step. Doesn't speak about turning away from thoughts or delusions. Roshi speaks about opening the hand of thought, releasing them, not pushing them away. A former teacher of mine spoke about attaching Dharma habits and allowing afflictions to liberate themselves. So we have this sense. Dogen says to carry oneself forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. Then myriad things come forth and illuminate the self, according to one translation, or illuminate themselves, another. This is awakening. So we maybe could twist that just a little bit. You know, I feel empowered to do that because Dogen sort of twists things around all the time, and say to carry the self forward and to carry the self forward to speak back to the myriad things is delusion. To allow myriad things to come forth and speak for themselves is awakening. You know, sit with that for a bit. Or we could say this. We could say in Zazen, we can let thoughts be thoughts, delusions be delusions, and so on. We can simply allow them to announce who they are and who we are without doing something about it, without saying anything back. then there is a chance, as Dogen also says, to give up being deluded about awakening and rather to awake to just listening and attending to thoughts, the arising delusions, settling, just confront that directly without this intermediary step of trying to impose oneself, to bring control, to put the monkey on a leash, all these kinds of images. In other words, become friendly with oneself, right? Now, just to tie things together a little bit, going back to the kind of deep listening that Taiken spoke about those years ago, I'm absolutely not suggesting that we treat what other people and other groups of people tell us as delusion. You probably will recognize that they, like every one of us, live and speak from within a world of greed, hate, and delusion. And, you know, what's the response to that? Well, it's compassion about our shared human karmic predicament, not turning away, and not listening. After all, delusion speaks its own truth, and in its odd way can even preach the Dharma. So, what I'm suggesting is that in conversation, in listening to others, if we wish to be fully present with what's happening without trying to control or judge it, if we want to let go of this inner clamoring that's so present, let go of our worn assumptions, open, fresh, alert, attentive, calm, receptive, we will need to bring into our listening something of the mind we become friends with in Zazen. That is to say, if we want to become truly able to listen deeply to others, it will serve us well first to learn how to step back, how to listen to ourselves without speaking back and before speaking to others. And just finally, I wish I could have figured out a way to bring it more explicitly and articulately into the conversation, but these thoughts have given me an opportunity to see again, especially when I in my musings make this transposition to this concept of broadening our injunction towards right speech into a more dyadic or multipolar kind of thing of just right conversation. This leads me to, again, to the consideration of the way that Zazen truly supports precept practice. I think we'll leave out the intermediary steps. We take this moment of the Eightfold Path, right speech, and this very, we're in the precept territory there. I just lost my thought. Yeah, no, I guess it's just that, we see that, again, that the precepts and applying that precept of right communication in our Zazen in a way, I mean, not consciously, but having that as our intention when we sit down, the precepts really support Zazen in that way. And, of course, it's clear that Zazen really supports the precepts. So I guess that's basically what I wanted to explore a little bit. I've had this notion for a long time. I don't think it really holds up with too much examination, but it has a kind of a heuristic use. And that's, I've come to think of Zazen, and I've said this before, people have heard me say it before, as Zazen as what precepts look like when you're on the cushion. And the precepts are what Zazen looks like if they're being practiced. Well, is what Zazen looks like when you're out walking around the world, in the world. And, I would just invite you to explore, think a little bit about the importance of deep listening as put forward by these folks in Vermont, as an important aspect of practice in both domains, the seated version and the out being in the world version. So thank you very much. Always a little disjointed, but there you go. So I'd certainly welcome any comments or questions or anything like that. Thank you.
And will you help us with online people too? Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Neozon, for bringing up this very timely and wonderful facet of Zazen. Keep listening. I have wondered if...
I have two things. One, thank you.
You're welcome.
So three things. Second, this reminded me of a talk I gave at Rockefeller.
Maybe it was you who gave me the idea.
I gave a talk about like listening to Dharma talks and like, my experience listening to Dharma talks and like what it's like to be on the cushion listening to a Dharma talk. And somebody came to me after, who was a regular at Rockefeller. Someone came up to me afterward and went, "You know, I actually don't like your talks, but this one was great." I'm like, "What are you listening to?" So there's that. Two, some years ago, I'm not going to go down the therapist route. There's so many of us here. Back when I was doing my MDiv and stuff, I was spending a decent amount of time at a Jodo Shinshu Pure Land temple. And for those who are unfamiliar, Pure Land does not do Zazen. Like, there's some syncretism depending on, you know, which sect and tradition, but for the most part, they don't do Zazen. What they do is a little more on the devotional side, but like sort of common language is listening for Amida's vow, Amida Buddha's vow. That's the Buddha that they focus on. And I was really curious because I think I entered it with like, "Oh, what is this? This is a little cheesy, right? It looks like church." But over time, I noticed that there was a lot of alignment between like listening to the primal vow of Amida Buddha and Zazen. And it was really a lot of it was about like when someone is coming to speak to you, that you are really listening with compassion and you are hearing the compassion in whatever it is they are speaking, even if it's obscured or something, that everything becomes a sort of opportunity for awakening through listening, not for Amida's vow. But I noticed that there was, you know, in that tradition, there's quite a lot of stuff about listening and hearing.
Really? That's very interesting. I mean,
I'll stop. I can keep going.
Oh, you're welcome.
No, I can keep going.
Oh, okay. No, I mean we will be saying in a few minutes, Dharma gates are boundless, and we vow to enter them. And again, I mean it's just I don't think I'm giving anybody news, but I don't often myself personally remind myself explicitly that every conversation. Every encounter with a person, no matter how seemingly trivial, is an opportunity to receive Dharma. The problem being, of course, that often we're a little bit too self-involved or whatever to truly engage it, to even hear it, let alone listen to it.
You had something to get to?
Of so many things. After what you just said, I was thinking about there was a story that Richard Baker, who was the abbot of Zen Center after Suzuki Roshi, had a dream that he was trying to figure out the answer to a question. And he was in an office where the phone was ringing. He was getting really upset and going, I wish that phone would stop ringing. It's bothering my concentration, you know. Then he picks up the phone and the answer is on the phone, you know. And I think so many times when we're really not attending to all of our senses, whether it's nobles hearing, ennobling hearing, ennobling tasting, ennobling touching, ennobling vision, you know, that we know the difference. But a lot of times, you know, the answer is right there always. But we don't pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Because, you know, of defensiveness or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So that's my response.
Cool. Thanks for your talk. At actually the school that Dylan and I work at, we've been practicing this year, like having better sort of student discussion in class, you know, and encouraging that more and figuring out different ways of having that. And so that's been a challenge, right? And my assistant principal came to observe like my class a while back, and she saw that sometimes I had the tendency to, like, I teach fourth grade, and when students would, like, share or, you know, comment on something or try to answer a question, like, I would often, like, jump in afterwards to, like, you know, try to, like, like, make more sense of, like, what they had said. You know, I was, like, frequently commenting on what the kids said, and, you know, and I could recognize in myself that a lot of that was, like, anxiety of, like, oh, are they making, like, sense to each other? You know, is this going to, like, help the conversation along, et cetera? And she's like, just, you know, like, let them talk a little bit, you know, and be okay with just kind of having their voices be the voices in the room without you kind of indulging your need to, like, always be, like, tying the thing together. And so that's been, like, really helpful and, like, kind of difficult just to kind of listen and then, you know, put the brake on my own, like, tendency to, like, want to jump in and like, kind of control, like, what's happening in the classroom. It's been, like, more fun that way, too. And so, anyway, that's how I kind of related to, you know, that listening and just, like, yeah, like, not, I guess not bringing myself forward a little bit in that situation, so.
Oh, thank you, Bo. That's really interesting. I mean, one aspect of that that was present in what you said but not highlighted is a lack of a better word, we might call a power differential, you know, and those are all over the place. People, you know, exercise varieties of kinds of authority. You know, I have a particular kind of authority here by virtue of having been invited to sit in this seat. And it's good to be aware of that so that you can do exactly what you described, because when we're in that position, we're often kind of blind to it and or unthinking about it, and it can engender a kind of something. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think you had your hand up, and then we'll go to David. Paul?
Yep.
Paul, and then David, and then Eve, maybe, and that's probably tickets 211.
Thank you. Yeah, for your talk. And I was just going to say that when I hear deep listening, the first thing I think of is Pauline Oliveros, who I was curious if other folks had heard of, but it's like she's an experimental musician who was, like, very active in, like, I think it was like the 70s, 80s, 90s, but she wrote, like, the book on what I think of as the book on deep listening, and it, for her, I think, was more along the lines of, like, sometimes it was like going into nature, other times it was like, you know, going into like a big cistern and like making weird reverberating sounds and like, but about like, if you listen, there is a music you can find in whatever kind of noise you're picking up on. And I think was just thinking about, like, it's kind of, like, in a sense, it's a different mode of listening from, like, when you're trying to hear the words someone is saying and actually interpret and understand what they're trying to get you to understand. And I guess now I'm just kind of pondering, like, is there, like, kind of an overlap between, like, really deeply listening to, like, what sound is being heard and the words someone's trying to say, but also just say, Bo, you're making me think of, like, trying to do, like, with sixth graders, like, trying to do, like, a food meditation. And, like, one of the steps in the process we would have them do would be, like, to hold the Snickers bar, like, up to their ear and just, like, listen to the Snickers bar. And, like, it really did something. I think that that was one that got them out of their, like, sort of default mind and just kind of got them, like, listen to the Snickers bar. That kind of would click for them, and suddenly they might, you know, be a little bit more present and included in what we're doing. So, Well, eventually, it's torturous, I guess, but, like, you know, you put it in your mouth, and you, like, have to let it sit there for a bit, and then some of them have that stuff out.
Abuse in the schools.
And Nathan online said he was thinking of Pauline Oliveros as well.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pauline Oliveros, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, this thing you raised, Paul, of how this kind of a topic might, you know, I will say I was thinking, you know, of listening strictly within the domain of speech itself. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting idea to think about how these areas overlap. I don't have any particular thoughts at the moment, although I'm sure it will be on my mind later today. And if you have any, maybe you could share them another time.
I would want to just amplify a little what you said, Paul, and that Pauline Oliveros, hearing the music in everything, it's like hearing the Dharma in everything, and smelling and tasting and touching it. So there is, I think, a resonance with what you've been talking about in Oliveros' work. You know, even if hers is more wordless, you could say, but there's still this finding the music, melody, harmony, resonance, and in things that we might not necessarily want to hear or think of as such.
Now I'm inspired to go home and reread The Intention, Teach Dharma, mm-hmm. Means Teach Dharma. I can't remember how that passage is entitled. Thank you. David?
Yeah, a couple of things. Well, one, I may add. First, I vowed I wasn't going to speak today at all.
I hear you, brother.
Okay. But something Bo said, and I would offer Bo that sometimes, and I know I find it, especially with patients, they need to be heard. They want to know that they're heard. They want to have that sense of validity, especially at the end of life. And I do something called active listening, which is not the same as deep listening. It's a little different. Active listening is I repeat what they said, but I don't use their exact words. If they said, I lived in New York, I don't say, you live in New York. I say, you were once living in an area that's on the East Coast called New York. Is that correct? So I'm rephrasing what they're saying, and that way they get to say, yes, you heard me. Mm. And I think that's real important, that you try to make sure that people know that you heard them. You know, in a clinical situation, that's important, but in everyday life, we all want to be heard. And so if we could let people know that they're heard, it's one form of connection. That's, to me, that was a real part of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Deep listening comes, and I found with me, in my everyday life, I'm going all over the place. But when I'm with a patient, all of a sudden I'm focused on them. And it's connection. This is all about connection. And how I see this is, I'm with this person. And Bernie Glassman talked about this, famous Zen teacher. Bernie Glassman talked about it. And Joan Halifax, who studied with Bernie, mentioned it in her training, about coming in with no agenda. That when I listen to somebody, I don't have agenda. I'm just listening. I'm not saying, how am I going to fix this person? How am I going to do this? I'm just listening. I'm bearing witness to their experience. What is their experience? and how can I be connected with them? And I find it very liberating. I feel more fulfilled when I'm with patients than I do in my rest of my everyday life, because I'm focused and concentrating on connecting with them and being with them with no agenda. And that, I think, is crucial. And all the precepts are about connection, not killing, not stealing, not abusing sexuality. You know, all of them, not lying, not denigrating somebody. Fifth and sixth, seventh precepts are all about being connected to people. They're all about connection, at least from my perspective. And I offer that to you, your comment on that.
I totally agree, and I really, really appreciate your bringing that up. I cannot speak for other people. I can only speak for myself. But for years and years and years, despite the fact, that if you think about the precepts or read through the precepts or the Eightfold Path, it's massively about, as you say, relationship, connection with other people. And, maybe because we come out of a, Judeo-Christian background, many of us, it took me a long time to realize that. I was somehow, talk about not listening, not hearing what's being presented there. Somehow I was thinking this, it had to do with what kind of a person I am, something about my soul. Buddhists don't do souls, Buddhists, other people, yes, but, that's a very crudely put, but I think it's very important to realize that a whole lot of what we presented in Dharma is not facing first here. It's like guiding you on how you bring this out. So that's really important. I also appreciate your bringing forth the notion of witnessing, because flipping the thing back around to Zazen is a kind of listening. I don't, when the stuff comes up in me, I don't always bring the same generosity and compassion to it that I try to bring to other people. I feel like I've got some sort of warrant that makes it justifiable or desirable not to be compassionate to myself. And so, and a lot of that happens, it happens on the cushion. And so bring this idea of witnessing. I mean, it's not new information for what happens in Zazen, but it's a new kind of label that can serve as a reminder to, in Zazen, to be engaged, but to not try to police your mind. Let it romp and play in samadhi, as one of our ancestors said. I don't mean wandering mind, but not trying to impose. Let it come forth and realize itself, biting nowhere, Eve.
So I think this is an extremely timely topic. And I don't know if you're going to want to answer this question or not, but it's what came up for me. I mean, in listening and trying to listen, and that goes for face-to-face, but also listening to what's online, listening to what people are writing. So in trying to listen, what I've come up with so far is that people are deeply concerned with justice and fairness, but people are defining it differently. I mean, people have different interpretations of what's just and what's fair. But it has struck me that there's a common concern around that. But I don't know what to do with that.
What do you mean when you say you don't know what to do with that?
Well, it's like the so what? So like, okay, if you're listening and you come, and if you're face to face, you check what you've heard, etc. Yeah, but then what?
Good question.
So I wondered when you were saying that, if you really feel like, oh, a lot of people, including myself, I'm concerned with justice and fairness, that's a place to start. That's a common ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, even someone that might really fiercely disagree with how what they think is fair, to say, of course you want the world to be fair and just. I do too. So that's a ground of connecting when you can see that broader picture, I think. But you still have to look for your own agenda. Go, oh, am I trying to get my agenda across here with my understanding of fairness and justice? The ego is a sneaky thing.
with not only my, but with the correct understanding.
Yeah, exactly. And also then you act, right?
Yeah. Say that again.
Then you act.
Then, yeah.
Like, you know, we also, it does not mean that you're totally passive. This reminds me that I posted in the kitchen that I received from a group in New Orleans, Mid-City Zen, an invitation to join their discussion of the precepts and events in response to issues in Palestine and Gaza. And I think that, you know, so there's dialogue and there's a way, but I think it's just a lot slower because it's hard to drop our agendas. And so I think it's a great starting place to go, oh, we're talking about justice and fairness. Who doesn't want that? Maybe there are a couple people who don't. Some people might say they do, but they really don't. But it's a great place to start. All beings want to be happy.
Maybe. So thank you, Eve. Thank you.
Okay.
So I don't know, is this, when do we try to stop at 11 or 11? When
this is a good time to stop. So what we do is we start with the Bodhisattva vows, and then you'll go up and do your vows while we're vowing, and then we'll have announcements with the Eno, and then we'll get up and arrange our cushions, etc.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nielsen.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize.